This audio is a recording of a Better Questions seminar on social movements and praxis made in March 2010 in Shrewsbury. The speakers are Teresa O'Keefe, a feminist academic and activist working at NUIM, who presents on feminist praxis, possible lessons for achieving change, and Fergal Finnegan, a community educator and activist from Dublin. He gives a short introduction to the ideas of Paulo Freire entitled Hope, Cultural Politics and Popular Education. This audio of the talks is accompanied by a second audio, which is the discussion that followed the talks. You can find that one on indymedia.ie or at anarchism.pageabout.com. For more information on Better Questions, see thought-movement.blogspot.com.
Okay, we're just going to get started. Thanks a lot for coming along tonight. This is the fourth session of Better Questions seminar series that's been happening here in Shrewsbury. The last three discussions are online on IndyMedia. The audio files are there to be downloaded and listened to if you want. Tonight the discussion is on praxis, and we'll start with Fergal Finnegan, who will present a series of ideas from Paulo Freire entitled Cultural Politics and Popular Education, and following that, Teresa O'Keefe will present on feminist practice, possible lessons for achieving change.
I guess I should clarify kind of where I'm coming from on this as well. I'm from Canada. I've been living here for 6 years or so, and very much active in kind of feminist campaigns, but more so even kind of anti-capitalist, anti-corporate globalization stuff in Canada. And my feminist stuff really mostly takes place kind of within the university setting kind of as well. So that kind of gives you an idea of where I'm coming from on this. What I plan to do is just kind of give an overview of feminist praxis, just very briefly, and some kind of examples of what it has looked like. And I think really importantly for this session, I want to talk about what I think are some of the mistakes that have been made with regard to feminism. And I have some questions that I'd like to put to you in terms of how you think that we should move forward. So that's okay, that's kind of what I'm going to cover. So if we want to kind of come up with a definition of what feminist praxis is, it's a combination of feminist theories that look at power as something that's social, something that's cooperative, and something that's enabling. And that's kind of, it can be a controversial definition of power depending on how you come at it. Women's kind of diverse needs, their values, and their experiences are taken into account, and it's this analysis that kind of aims to give voice to women. And of course, the heart of feminist praxis is the attempt, or the relationship between experience and theory. So praxis is not just knowledge, but it's, you know, what is knowledge for example. So the point is to change the world in terms of, no matter what type of feminism we're looking at, it's not just to study it, right? So feminist praxis links to theories and also the practices of women's groups, of activists, of writers, of, you know, people like myself and Hillary who work within universities, you know, across a variety of institutions and informal collectivities. And the idea is kind of to analyse this to make sense of ourselves and kind of where we fit, you know, within the world. And there's a whole debate around that which I won't go into. Of course, how feminist praxis has materialised is most obviously in the university environment. You know, feminism is reshaping curriculum in disciplines as well as in interdisciplinary studies. And feminist scholars are very much connected to women's groups as well. Like in Ireland, of course, you have the Feminist Open Forum or something like Hannah's House, which is very much a combination of people who work within community groups and within the university as well. But, you know, to be a feminist is to be involved kind of beyond theorizing and researching. So if you're only theorizing and researching, you're really not considered, you know, a good kind of feminist, right? You're not doing feminist practices. And I'm going to critique this in a minute, but I think that discussion of praxis is quite common, and actually more common within the university, academic discussions around epistemology and research. And again, I think that this is a way in which feminist praxis has kind of lost its way over time, and I want to come back to that in a minute. I guess one of the kind of initial writers in the area of feminist praxis was Charlotte Bunch, and she outlines four steps to build kind of feminist theory: description, analysis, vision, and strategy. So it's not only about developing some grand meta-narrative, grand theory. It's about a vision for change and a strategy for change that's wrapped up in that. And it's the last two that really differentiate feminist theory from other research processes. What else do I want to say on that? I think I'm going to talk in a second about how there are different types of feminist practices, but what they all would, I think, have in common is this idea that feminist practice is about being able to speak for yourself. It's the practice of speaking for oneself from our own knowledge through doing, and this is foundational to feminist practice. And this, in turn, has fostered the development of a method and an inquiry into what is social and what is political, and that this is anchored in people's everyday lives and everyday experiences. And I think that this is really important in one sense because it has changed how we as academics even kind of do research. You know, we've moved away from the kind of this positivist, androcentric focus on doing research, which is about, you know, number crunching, for example, as opposed to taking into account people's experiences of giving voice, you know, the act of giving voice. Now, as I said, there's different approaches to feminist praxis. And it's something I think that takes a unique shape depending on what type of feminism you're talking about, you know, liberal, Marxist, post-structuralist, whatnot. I'm not going to go into all of them, but I'm just going to kind of make a couple of points about one or two. I think it's important, because in relation to the questions I want to put to you after, if we consider black feminist praxis, for example, which developed in the US. And what's particularly striking about black feminist praxis is the coalition building between black females and black males. And few other approaches have been articulate or as aggressive as black feminism in constructing a holistic social movement that examines the motivations that draw minority women to men in their community. And this really has implications. We look at, for example, radical feminism, I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself here, which for radical feminists, of course, you know, the ideal form of praxis is something which involves a separation from working with within male institutions, male groups, male organizations, right? But I'll come back to that in a second. Materialist praxis, and this is probably something that we're all familiar with in this room, and I think it's something that probably, hopefully, has kind of the most resonance and most potential today as, you know, the struggle against kind of capitalism, I think, intensifies. And materialist feminists, you know, socialist or Marxist feminists, they actually use the term praxis as a means of acknowledging the process of making feminist changes. So in that process, we also change our theory and ourselves and our vision in terms of what is possible. So praxis means for them to develop new theories. I'm kind of jumping back and forth here. And, you know, thinking through what we have learned by acting on old ones, but even more importantly, something that is talked about in relation to materialist feminism is hidden knowledge, things that we aren't kind of aware of because our society doesn't put value on these different types of knowledges and experiences. So for materialist feminism, it's kind of about uncovering what they call hidden knowledge and putting value on that. In kind of the early years of women's liberation, materialist feminism kind of came into existence alongside of radical feminism. And socialist feminist practice in particular didn't really follow kind of any orthodox set of ideas. And it was really actually guided by the social conditions that birthed it, which is something in a way we have in common today. And something I think that can be useful if we kind of look back at that and apply it to today. And of course, it was in between, as I said, emerging between the radical left, radical feminists, and what happened was that many women were fed up with the sexism that was taking place in the left. And socialist feminists actually believed that their practice needed to include a fight for their own liberation. And at the same time, they actually did not agree that women's liberation could be achieved separately from other struggles. So as a result, socialist feminists saw the fight to end male supremacy as a key for social justice, but not actually its primary condition. So it was something amongst many, right? And I want to come back to that because I want to talk about issues around solidarity as well. And again, radical, I think, practice is something that we're probably most familiar with, but probably not in terms of actually naming it. And I think it's because radical feminism, in some ways, has had the most success in terms of practice. So for radical feminist practice, understanding the oppression of women should be based on feelings, it should be based on personal experiences, and not existing ideologies, because all existing ideologies were created within patriarchal society, right? So they developed, first of all, a theoretical framework for understanding male violence and aggression towards women, the use of demeaning and destructive patriarchal images of women. They looked at the relationship between sex and love and male dominance. And part of the kind of the praxis element that developed as a result ranged from what Adrienne Rich would call the lesbian continuum, where you have women on kind of a scale where the objective is to kind of be women-identified women. So whether you were a straight woman or a lesbian depends on kind of where you landed on that continuum. But the idea is to build solidarity and friendships and to identify with other women and to have a woman-identified culture. And we see kind of how this has been put into practice when we look at things like feminist conscious raising. We look at women-only spaces. We look at women-only classes in the US in particular, which were shut down amongst a kind of blaze of controversy. And in general, then, if we want to talk about that in relation to feminist practice, we look at that in terms of socialist feminism and in terms of radical feminism, because those are the two strains that really sought any kind of transformative or engaged any kind of transformative exercise, and we want people to kind of bother engaging with notions of liberal feminism. I don't think there's really any point. That's my own bias. But if we talk about what kind of the end result was in terms of socialist feminism and radical feminism in terms of practice, the creation of women's studies departments that would be considered feminist praxis. And within that then, feminist pedagogy, feminist research methods. So, as I said before, prior to kind of the influence of feminism within academia, there was a very different way of going about doing research and a very different way of understanding how we know the things we know about the world. And feminism came along and critiqued that. It critiqued how we do science, critiqued how we study the world. And it's been a long process, but now it's kind of revolutionized within, you know, fields like sociology or politics, for example. We can do and kind of publish in and kind of produce work that is, say, standpoint theory, where it's completely based on one's own personal knowledge and one's own personal experiences. This is something that is not kind of valued by the male norm that kind of identifies what is good research or not within academia. And let me see what else I want to say there. Feminist consciousness raising, women's only spaces, things like women's aid, they are examples of kind of feminist praxis. And I think even if we look at kind of less institutional examples, I think, anyway, my own research shows, I think, that you only really have to look at look within nationalism to see examples of feminist praxis. If we look at progressive types of nationalism, for example, the PKK, you know, the Kurdish Workers' Party, is a great example of that. You know, week-long classes in feminist consciousness raising, or in feminism, and also in terms of putting male comrades through an exercise of feminist consciousness raising. And if the women in the group decide that these men haven't been kind of at their conscious level, hasn't been sufficiently raised, that they have to then be reevaluated. Do they have a place within the movement? So that's, I think, a really interesting kind of practical example. And there's loads more. But and I think you probably might have gathered as I've gone through the talk, and could probably kind of highlight some mistakes or some problems with feminist praxis. My big critique of feminist praxis, I think, and I think it's a fair one, is that it's become institutionalized, and that feminism itself has become institutionalized, and as a result, it's de-radicalized the movement. It's making it institutionally driven, it's elite driven, it's Western driven, and I think, again, if we look at how praxis gets defined and discussed, it's oftentimes it's done in the context of methodology, of epistemology, so, you know, academic terms, using academic exclusionary language, right? And I think that an interesting kind of process has happened here. So, you know, feminists thought this is great. We are having women's studies programs where we are able to really do feminist praxis by engaging in theory and analysis and practice, changing the world in this kind of setting. But as a result, I think it's fair to say that feminism itself has become marginalized and to a certain extent seen as inconsequential. And I think that the closing of women's studies departments in this country and in other parts of Europe and North America as well are very much indicative of this. And I think there was a kind of a pattern. Initially, there was kind of pressure for women's studies departments to change their name to gender studies departments. Like, it wasn't acceptable to talk only about women. And I think an important part of feminist praxis is to be able to talk about women and to have women's spaces. So we went from being forced to kind of call these gender studies as opposed to women's studies, and now they're being closed down altogether. But I think there's a second kind of prong, a second kind of parallel here that's very much related, and that's the co-opting of women's groups by the state. You know, feminist groups have become women's groups. Very rarely do we hear the use of the word feminist to define any few community groups, particularly in Ireland. And the state has very cleverly, I think, mainstreamed women's issues. It's de-radicalized them. It's transformed them into gender issues. You know, the state likes to pretend that it's very much committed to these types of issues and that it put out all kinds of ambiguous, you know, fluff called, you know, gender this and gender that. And now what they've done, they're actually trying to get kind of rid of them altogether. And I think the community development schemes are a good example of that. You know, many women were involved in community development schemes working on women's issues, but they were never specifically or explicitly identified as being feminist. And I think part of the issue is that feminists themselves became content with women's projects as opposed to feminist projects, being committed to the core of what it is to be a feminist. It became about gender as opposed to kind of feminist ideology. And this, again, this is true, very much true in North America as well. And also I think, to a certain extent, third wave feminism, which is what people say we're in now, has, in effect, made feminism seem like it's passé, that we don't need it anymore. And, you know, third wave feminism has been very detrimental to this. So they do, third wave feminism, it places kind of emphasis on agency, which is important because this is something that kind of radical feminist praxis was kind of a little bit quiet on. But it's become problematic because, you know, what does praxis look like now? What's a feminist praxis look like now in this kind of third wave environment? Well, we have overly sexualized and overly feminized bodies without any kind of critique, for example, of why women feel the need to engage in this type of gender performance. There's no critique about, you know, why women do the things they do, for example. As opposed to with, you know, socialist feminists and radical feminists, this understanding that kind of everything we do is bound up within this patriarchal society. So I hope, anyway, this is the three questions that I've kind of pulled out of what I just said. And for me, I think three key things that we should be talking about, at least that are important to me as kind of an advocate capitalist feminist. The first question will be, how do we build coalitions with those who oppress us? So, for radical feminists, you know, autonomous organizing was something that was very much important, autonomous organizing for women. And that's very much in opposition to black feminist praxis, which was all about solidarity.
What's a tongue?
What's a tongue?
Yeah.
Autonomous.
Oh, autonomous. Sorry, autonomous. So they like all women. So autonomous as in all women's groups are just working kind of on women's issues, as opposed to like RAG, for example, who very much are situated within like anti-capitalist kind of anarchist stuff, but they, you know, they're part of kind of a broader movement, right? Does that explain? Is that clear? Yeah?
Yeah.
So, like, autonomous organizing versus organizing in solidarity. And again, as I said, you know, this is, I think, implications for many of us, many feminists who work within anti-capitalist groups, for example. We have to kind of make sure that what happened in the 70s, I think, doesn't happen again. And so we need to ask, you know, where is the line between working in solidarity and working with or even working for our oppressors? And I think that's an uncomfortable question, but it's a question that we need to ask. Secondly, how do we avoid being co-opted? And I think from the perspective of feminism, this is a really important question, even though one could argue that it's at the heart of feminist practices. And also, I think the third question should be, how do we make feminist practices real and relevant again? You know, not something that is not really a state apparatus, and I would get kind of in a lot of trouble for saying that, you know, with many other feminists, but something that really isn't a state apparatus, something that's exciting, something I think that is operating kind of from the bottom up as opposed to from the top down, which is, in my opinion, where it's at right now.
What I'm going to do is give a very brief and basic introduction to the ideas of the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire, and hopefully, along with what Teresa said now, with some pointers for a conversation. To do that, I'm going to do three things. I'm going to give the biographical and historical context. I'm going to identify the main strands in his thinking, and I'm going to talk a little bit about practical applications of those ideas. Freire was born in 1921, and by his death in 1997, he was one of the three most famous intellectuals who dealt with education in the world. He became synonymous with popular education and has inspired generations of both activists and educators. I think the interesting question is actually to ask yourself how that happened, or why that happened, why he became such a global figure, and at that time. I mean, his writing has genuine scope. It has a very engaging generosity of spirit, and a sharp sense of indignation at social injustice. But he's certainly not a secular saint, you know. He's sometimes when people discuss Freire, he's like this holy figure. I think simply the reason why he's important is simply that he emerges from social movements, and that he elaborates the good sense within social movements and then gives it a philosophical depth. So what I'm saying is the importance of Freire is that at a certain particular historical conjuncture, he was involved in social movements and he used that experience to elaborate the philosophy. And I think in that sense, Freire is really part of a longer history, part of 200 years of developing practices and ideas which are commensurable with radical social goals. How do we educate ourselves? It's a perennial question of radicals, you know, and it's always been to the fore. And I think he's very good at addressing some of the questions which I suspect better questions set out to address, which is, what do we mean by radical knowledge? What is it? What's that?
The roof.
That's the etymology of it. But I mean, what are the conditions by which it comes about? What are the obstacles to it? And I think particularly amongst this group, I think the question of what role does the university play in all this, you know, or should it play a role, you know, coming back to what we were discussing last week, or 2 weeks ago, sorry. Having said all that, I'll give you a little bit more biographical information. He came to prominence in Brazil in the late 1950s through to the early 60s. He was involved in a series of mass education projects of peasants and workers. It's not particularly clear whose agenda he was working for or towards at that point, but what is clear is that the 60s saw a real radicalisation of Freire. I mean, part of it is simply what happened in Brazil. There was a coup in 1964. He gets imprisoned for a relatively short period, and then he goes to Chile to do similar type of work. But I think it's actually he's absorbing a lot of social and intellectual currents around him. I think he takes heart from and is given confidence by that whole wave of post-colonial rebellion, a confidence that education could remake the world. I think it's very clearly in his work. And he synthesizes, and it's a very unusual synthesis, actually, and people don't really know this that often. He brings together stuff which really shouldn't fit together, and he puts it together in a very interesting synthesis. He obviously draws on Marxism, but he's not exclusively a Marxist. He draws on certain types of Marxism, and then he brings liberation theology in. he also brings a degree of critical social psychology and existentialism into his philosophy. And I think once you see that those set of influences, you can begin to understand why he began to have such an impact. And all that emerges in his most famous book, his second book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is finished in the late 60s. And that book makes him an international figure. After that, right through the 70s and 80s, he's crisscrossing Africa, Latin America, and North America. He's teaching in Harvard, he's working in Geneva, he becomes an advisor to the revolutionary government in Guinea-Bissau in West Africa. He visits Nicaragua, so he becomes a sort of a figurehead for a whole set of historical events. I mean, that's okay, isn't it?
Fair enough.
And in that time, over the next sort of from the late 60s to the late 90s, he produces, I think, 15, 20 books, refining these ideas, returning to these ideas, readdressing them in the light of practice. He registers a lot of early feminist criticisms of his work, and he brings that in. He clearly registers the destruction of the Soviet Union and the growth of neoliberalism. But I think, by and large, Freire's philosophy of education and philosophy of social action remains relatively consistent right through that time. So now, what I would say to give you a sort of boiled down version of what that means, I think it really just means he keeps coming up with two points, and it's this, that firstly, you can't understand education without understanding the politics of education, and secondly, that radical social change is always a process of social learning. And I think it's that inside-outside perspective that makes it quite powerful. And if you break that down, I would identify three major elements. The first is, and this, excuse me if it sounds grandiose, there's no way of saying this differently. He has a very strong conception of what it means to be human at the heart of his work, and it keeps coming up. And he tirelessly traces tensions between what he sees as the capacities of human beings and the limits imposed upon them. There's rarely a page of Freire which doesn't use this model. And in the right conditions, what he says is that human beings are curious, open, creative, and given to seeking autonomy, whilst strengthening links of interdependence. So Freire, at our best, we're radically unfinished human beings. We're always in the process of becoming, alive to new possibilities. If that all sounds a little bit too airy-fairy and bright, I don't think it is, because he links that to quite a dry-eyed critique of the limits put on our capacity to be human. I'm not sure if he's very good at particularly explaining the structures that produce them, but he's very good at explaining the effects of domination on human beings. And he talks a lot about how domination creates a fear of freedom, a sort of winnowing of your own sense of agency. How people get locked into cultures of silence, who learn to either be compliant or accepting of the conditions of the dehumanisation of their own life. So that's the first part of his philosophy. It's strongly linked to the second part, which is his theory of knowledge. For Freire, how we learn and how we understand, how we actually know in the world, is part of the struggle for humanisation. For Freire, knowledge is always about power, and therefore all learning and education is political in the broad sense of that word, not in the party political sense of that word. And again, his point of reference begins with a very strong critique of how we understand knowledge in most educational and social settings. And he's critical of what he calls the banking system of education. And it is what it really sounds like. He's critical of a notion of knowledge that says knowledge is out there, it's static, it can be compartmentalized, and it's simply about the transfer of units of knowledge, the deposits of knowledge given by a knower to the ignorant. Okay, the typical pedagogical situation. You know, I know something, you don't, lap it up. Okay, and he says that that isn't just that's not a mistake. That's not to do with bad intentions. What that does is it reflects broader social relations. What that relationship to knowledge is a relationship to agencies. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And what he counterposes to that is knowledge which is created in egalitarian conditions. You participate in the process of making and remaking knowledge. Knowledge isn't a given, it's a process of making meaning. And that, once again, can never be completed. I think there's a crossover with some feminist ideas here, and I think this is really important in terms of politics. And I think if there's one thing I'm going to say during this talk, this is the major point. He says that there is no way that you can have radical political action. There is no way that you can have useful, empowering education unless you begin with people's lived experience. That has to be the base from which you start. And you respect people's expectations, you respect their experience, and you try and understand their needs from their point of view. Without that, it is an imposition. So that's the core idea. Now, this isn't some sort of therapy-like version of education. This isn't experiential education per se. What he means is that experience becomes the raw material by which you investigate the rest of the world. That you investigate the world with methodological rigor, with real intent, with using all the intellectual tools at your disposal to reframe that, to look at your experience again, to say what's it linked to, where does this put me, how did I articulate my experience in these terms, is sort of what he's getting at. And I think it's really obvious that departs from the standard model of intellectual work. Because really what that says is education and radical politics is one part specific intellectual skills. He doesn't dump on them. He doesn't say, oh, you know, we should throw out all philosophy. He says it's there to be used, but he says it's only one constituent element. And it's the other element there, that ability to be relatively humble in the face of other people's experience, that ability to listen, that ability to actually learn from other people's experience, it's dead, it's desiccated, it's static. Okay? It's just a sort of version of banking education with good intentions. Does that make sense? Okay. So I think what you're hearing already between that theory of being and that theory of knowledge is you can already trace the elements of how he sees praxis. Okay? Praxis for him is collective social reflection on experience, expectation, and projects of the future. Then acting upon that in the world, and then returning to reflection. So it's this gyre whereby you move from the concrete to the abstract, back into the concrete. Yeah, that's his model of praxis. Now, that clearly, he's very clear that this means that you can't have vanguards of any sort. You know, that will undermine that egalitarian relationship. You can't simply rely on experts. Now, it's a little bit unclear, and I think it's a weakness in this, how this relates generally to an overall social project of radical change. It's a little bit unclear, and maybe we'll talk about that later. But I think he does do a very good job at saying, for anybody who's an activist, for anybody who's an educator, your work has to be strongly contextualised, and when you bring universal aspirations to a context, you have to pay attention to the particular conditions you're in and the shape of it and how people speak about it, otherwise you're lost. And the whole point, and this is something which isn't stressed in a lot of critical educational work, the point of this is to make hope realizable and despair unconvincing. He puts tremendous store by the fact that by posing questions in a horizon of possibility, you can remake the world. So none of this will work without hope. It doesn't, you know, without hope, without a vision of social emancipation, once again, it's dead. Okay. If I've given you a bit of biographical and historical context, then that's the core ideas in this philosophy. I want to talk a little bit about how that applies. How am I doing for time? Am I okay?
Yeah,
of course. How that might apply in real life. Now, there's a tremendous amount of Ferrarian and Ferrarian influence projects across the world. You know, everything from the MSG, which is the Landless Movement in Brazil, through to higher education programs in LA on global citizenship, through to community development projects in Kilbarra. There's a ton of these things. The most exciting, a lot of the most exciting are in Latin America. There's a particularly strong tradition of popular education there. And if people are interested in that, there's a very good general introduction to that by a guy called Liam Kane. But when I was thinking about this talk tonight, I was thinking, okay, well, in a sense, that's too exotic. In a sense, you know, when you start talking about the MSD, it doesn't really talk about the situation we find ourselves in. And then I thought, okay, well, maybe I could talk about Trapeze, which a lot of you know, which was a popular education group mobilised around the G8 in Scotland. And the whole way anti-capitalists have used popular education. And I thought, well, in a way, that's too much about us. It doesn't give us a point of reference outside ourselves. So I thought of something far more humdrum, which is an adult education project in the working class area of Edinburgh, the ALP. And how they made these ideas work, and the project still exists today, but its heyday was about 15, 20 years ago. Was they said, yeah, we take these ideas seriously, and we want to run educational courses in this manner. And what they did is they spent months talking to people, interviewing them, knocking on doors, having focus groups, taking photographs, researching, some of them from that area somewhere, and actually then proposing to people, well, is this an interesting thing for you to deal with? National identity seems to be something that concerns you. Poverty is something that concerns you. Football is something that concerns you. And then they've built whole courses out of that. Now, once again, if we go back to that notion of praxis, it wasn't a given. You know, at that point, they talked to people, and at each point, they reflected on what they were doing and tried to build that into the course as it went on. That had small social gains, small political gains. There was nothing on the scale of the MST, there's nothing on the scale even of some of the stuff we've done as a unified anti-capitalist movement. But I think what it does is it shows you how the mechanics of this philosophy we might sound grandiose would work. I do have something in the back of my mind which I read about, which happened in Canada, which might be useful for the discussion in terms of how radical activists might work within popular education, but I don't want to do wax lyrical for too long. So that's more or less it. Is that okay?
Oh, great. Thanks very much.
This audio is a recording of a Better Question seminar on social movements and praxis made in March 2010 in Shomer Spree. The speakers are Teresa O'Keefe, a feminist academic and activist working at NUIM, who presents on feminist praxis, possible lessons for achieving change, and Fergal Finnegan, a community educator and activist from Dublin. He gives a short introduction to the ideas of Paulo Freire entitled Hope, Cultural Politics and Popular Education. This audio of the talks is accompanied by a second audio, which is the discussion that followed the talks. You can find that one on indymedia.ie or at anarchism.pageabout.com. The recording and editing was done by Andrew Flood. You'll find more articles and also more recordings I've done at anarchism.pageabout.com/user/AndrewNFlood.